Okay, thank you very much. My talk is partly conventional physics. I'm not making use of rather fancy ideas of string theory, ADS, CFT, or other rather speculative ideas, I would say, about physics. I'll try to be as least speculative as possible. However, in the very end, people might disagree with that. They might say what I am doing is even more speculative. Well, of course, the speculation is that all of physics should make sense. And if not, then I have to make some changes here and there. But those changes are, to my mind, minimal. But I'm pretty sure not everybody will agree. If you take a poll, it'll be something as mixed as usual. But let me try to explain the ideas about black holes. The whole thing started in 1915. Albert Einstein had just formulated his theory of general relativity when he got a letter by a famous astronomer, a well-known astronomer in Germany, Karl Schwarzschild, who said, wait a minute, dear Albert, if you wrote down these beautiful equations, but you only worked with approximations of the exact solutions. But if the case is fairly symmetric, I can write the exact solution for you. He understood the equations, he wrote them down, and he got this very well-known expressions for a black hole. Mind you that he did that calculation while he was serving for the German army, fighting against the Russians. There was gunfire all over, but somehow he said, this is a nice moment to do this calculation. And so he did the calculation with while under gunfire, and what is more, he also caught a very malicious disease of which he died a few months later. So I think in May 1916, he died because of the very severe autoimmune disease that he somehow caught, but I don't know much about those details. But anyway, so he wasn't there to participate in discussions that which took place years later about the solution that he wrote down. And the solution he wrote down was, now in modern notation it was this. He used slightly different notation. Also he was right away, of course he noticed the presence of this crazy singularity in solution. What if I goes to 2gm here, then the denominator vanishes and this goes to zero. That's clearly a singularity, but he realized, and in that much he understood of general relativity, that I was a freely defined parameter. He could just shift the parameter such that this singularity would be at the origin of space-time. And he thought that makes a lot more sense. So he put the origin of space-time at r, at where this r equals 2gm, rather than where this r is zero. And there's still some people who claim that therefore we are doing everything wrong, because Schwarzschild wrote his solution with this at the origin, and we shouldn't be talking about black holes. But of course, that was just a question of notation. And actually, I think Schwarzschild was a little bit mistaken when he made that jump. Because we now know that r equals 2m is not a singularity at all, but it is a horizon. So this is one of the many artist impressions you can give of a black hole. This is the horizon surrounded by a curved space-time, and the curvature basically goes to infinity, it seems, at the horizon, but actually not the curvature goes to infinity, but the choice of coordinates. Actually, if you would insist on having polar coordinates all the way, then you are in trouble, and then you get an apparent singularity at the horizon, which, but that, this particularly everybody agrees about now, is not a singularity at all. Even more so, there is a real singularity in the solution when this r goes to zero. That's way beyond the horizon. There is a real singularity. Now, here comes the first misconception that you still very often encounter, even in people who have studied black holes. They think that this singularity is at the real origin of space-time, and so that this is a real problem, that we have a solution with a singularity, and even though it's behind the horizon, it shouldn't be there. However, then in that case, people forget that this singularity is not a space-like separated, but time-like separated from the horizon. And only when time goes to infinity, you encounter the singularity. So as long as you do observations on black holes at a finite moment in time, and nobody has an infinite age anyway to the disposal, so it makes no sense to talk about the singularity, because you'll never be at the infinite future, whereas that's where the singularity lies. And I have explained.
Unless you fall into a black hole, then yeah. If you fall
then
it's very hard.
Yeah, but then you can no longer send your message out to the rest of the world. This is, of course, a very important point, and we all understand it well. This is the next picture. We'll come back to that, of course, because it's a very important point you bring forward. This is, you draw space time in. No, where is my pointer?
Do you want? I have another pointer.
Well, I use the hockey stick. Where is the hockey stick?
The other part.
Is there a hockey stick?
Do you mind this? No.
But I'm a bit afraid of this. I use the wrong end of the hockey stick. So, if you insist on keeping still the polar coordinates, where the radial distance is like this, the r coordinate runs horizontally and time runs vertically, then at 2gm, the local speed of light slows down to zero. And actually, the reason is that at r equals 2gm, this time coordinate used here goes to zero. And that is, of course, the zero that Schwarzschild encountered. Whereas if you go between this zero and the singularity, the light cone flips, and because space and time are interchanged. And that's easy to see when you go back to the metric. Back to this expression, you see a sign switch taking place if r gets across gm. So this becomes a time coordinate. This becomes a space coordinate. And you have to get used to that idea to see how what happens. So a somewhat better picture of the black hole is this, where you say a black hole formed by matter. So the time coordinate basically goes vertically here, but not quite, because inside the horizon, the light cone flips over. But now we make it flip over gradually, just to take into account that this is not a real singularity at all. This line here, this horizon, is just the geometrical figure you get if you take all points that are touching to the light cone, so that you can see that when you're on this horizon here, and you're moving at the local speed of light, you can still stay on the horizon, but you can't get out. As soon as you're beyond this point, your destiny is to be killed by this singularity. It's true that for the infalling observer, it only takes a finite amount of time, but what does it mean? The real question you have to ask is, what does an outside observer see about this? And of course, the outside observer is never worried by this singularity. You can... Actually, I want to emphasize that when we try to do quantum mechanics on this, then it becomes very much more important to talk about observers. In particular, we want to have the quantum mechanics straight for an observer who stays outside. In that case, the singularity is totally irrelevant for the discussion. And in fact, I'll say very little about it. It's there. In fact, if you change to other solutions, like the Kerr solution of the rotating black hole singularity, it makes place for a more complicated structure. And in Rice and neutrons, it's again different. So yes, there are the singularity. It depends very much what kind of black hole you're looking at. But in all these cases, it's unphysical, you could argue. You could also argue that it's important to know what happens to an observer who goes inside a black hole. Well, there we'll return to that, I hope. Yes?
Why we care about singularity? I thought it was because there's an assumption that there will be some scale below which, or above which, energy scale above which something else should happen, and that's a finite scale, and we don't know where that will be. We know it's between here and infinity; it has to exist. So at some point, the singularity hasn't actually formally become infinite, but things are getting denser and denser. At some point, we'll cross the
zone. So when you start talking about quantum mechanics, everything will change. And the similarity will see how that in my way of describing what happens in quantum mechanics, the similarity is practically no more at all. So you can say the things that you said, and I agree with that. But you also say, well, it doesn't really matter at all. The similarity is a little bit like the similarity that if you go to quantum space, you go, time, you add an imaginary component of time. think of that as moving.
Make sure the microphone is all off.
It's on your pocket, I think.
Sorry. So,
Zoom. I have no idea.
So, I'll be right
yeah. How is the touch on here, maybe? Inside
no,
here?
So.
Like this?
So.
It goes here, I think.
Okay.
There you go. Okay.
Okay.
Here, maybe.
Maybe turn like this.
Foam is not important, it just buckles.
This should be okay, and then it should be somewhere here. Is this the right place?
Is it good?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
Just make sure it's solid in there. Oh, it's not. Okay.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Then. Yes, when you look at planets moving in elliptical orbits, you can also ask the question, what happens when time becomes complex? And sure, in that solution, you'll find branch cuts and other kind of singularities all over the place. And with three or more planets, it gets even more complicated. But those, of course, in that case, you say it's not physical meaning at all. Time never becomes complex when you do physics. But then someone can say, yeah, but if I go there anyway, what happens? Well, then there's no need to correct for those cusps and singularities. They just tell you that there's interesting mathematics, but not interesting physics there. I think mathematics is very interesting, by the way. But anyway, the discovery by Penrose was to try to do away with these difficulties as much as possible by saying, I'm going to deform the coordinates such that the light cone points in a positive direction everywhere. And that makes the picture to some extent more transparent, but it generates other difficulties I'll mention shortly. That now, if you rotate the light cones back to the positive time direction everywhere, that's just a conformal transformation in your coordinates and easy to do. And what you then get is that when a black hole is formed by imploding matter, this is an imploding star, it eventually the star generates a singularity here. So here is the star has gone to a point, and that, of course, must be replaced with something else physically when a star collapses. But if that's the point, that from that moment on, there's a singularity here in the solution. Anybody moving to that point will hit a singularity, where the nature of the singularity here is not sensitive very much to what the star actually does here. So we had these situations, but the physical region of the black hole is this quadrant here, where you could consider early ingoing particles. You don't consider particles that go in very early. They are part of this star that collapses. But you start with your picture right here. And then you have this quadrant here, which represents the part of the universe that is still relevant for the discussion of the black hole. But why did I say that there are other problems with this picture? The problem is that it's very easy to make mistakes now. The mistake that many people make is they don't realize that at this point, you have an exponential dependence of physics on the coordinates. And the same thing here. Here, it's understandable. This is infinity of the universe, this entire quadrangle. This quadrangle is the entire universe. So this is infinity. This is past infinity. That's future infinity in the universe. And here at the horizon, you have an exponential compression of the ingoing particles. These exponents generate mistakes. And in particular, when people talk about the firewall, which they do in, when you try to discuss how to make black holes compatible with string theory, the firewalls are a consequence of underestimating the seriousness of this exponential behavior that both horizons actually have in this plot. All this is by now conventional physics. What I've said so far holds for the large black holes as much as it holds for small black holes. Small black holes, assuming that, you can do the classical approximation, saying a black hole is classical with some fluctuations that have quantum mechanics in them on top of them. You might or might not agree with that, but in any case, all these black holes allow for the same manipulations of their coordinates. They all seem to have horizons of the same nature. So far, so good. We've also seen that general relativity seems to be passing every test that we impose on it time and again. So general relativity is obviously a very good theory. So the question that is now still there, very much up in the air, is how to reconcile all this with quantum mechanics. Normally, one assumes quantum mechanics can safely be ignored. In fact, I will, in the end, I have put question marks even there, whether that's true or not. Even for black holes as large as the one that the previous speaker has been talking about, there could be some remainder of quantum effects in there. But I'm still not, it's still very confusing here, and there I don't have all the answers as yet. But in general, everything goes fine until black holes become as small as the Planck scale. Certainly, if they would be smaller than the Planck scale, quantum effects would not only dominate, they would take over completely. And particles smaller than that could as well be considered as being the true elementary particles. It's very difficult to see how physics can still look anything like it is today at scale smaller than 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So this is the smallest possible black holes that we can meaningfully talk about. Again, there will be very good reasons why black holes can't be much smaller than this. One is the microstate counting. If you take any kind of model of a black hole that agrees with what we know about it today, then you get that there's less than one microstate left if the sizes become much smaller than this. So this must be a limit. Exactly where the limit is very difficult to tell, but there must be a limit where the black hole is just 32 micrograms or in that domain of physics. You can ask, who cares? Because in astrophysics, there seems to be no obvious mechanism for black holes to be formed. So you can safely... how much time do I have? You can... Right. So you can safely assume that micro black holes of that sort do not even exist. Maybe they have never been formed in the universe. So you can certainly ask, what's the importance of trying to reconcile black holes in quantum mechanics? And my answer that it's very important. And very important because for a theorist, you want to have the complete picture, right? You want to have the exact set of laws of nature that describe everything that there is to be found in the universe. And if you can write down solutions of your equations, no matter how they got into being, if you can write down solutions that take the shape of a small black hole, and in principle you can imagine very small black holes to be formed, then we must understand how they behave. And we only accept theories that tell you correctly how such small objects behave. They're small, but they're very heavy. 22 micrograms is much heavier than any elementary particle by, again, many, many orders of magnitude. 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, by the way, is much smaller than any particle like the ones that we studied at CERN. It's still some 15 orders of magnitude or so smaller than that. So this is really very small. Then this guy sitting here had something to say about black holes, as you all know. And his main, I won't explain the picture any further unless someone asks me later. His main idea was that in order to do quantum physics in the vicinity of a black hole, something has to go and change in a rather remarkable way. But what he did was he did just a down-to-earth calculation. He said, I know quantum field theory, it's in the textbooks. I know general relativity is also in the textbooks. Why not put the two together and see what comes out? And his most immediate concern was, again, this quadrangle here, but I magnified here, in a quadrangle, there could be particles going into the black hole. In principle, particles could come out of a black hole from the past horizon, depending a little bit on how you look at the implosion process. But in general, I want to understand the physics of this whole thing. How do I write down consistent equations? And he got us to some difficulties. And then finally, then he said, well, maybe what I first have to ask is, how do I describe a situation if there's no particle? So what's the vacuum state surrounding the black hole? He got even more confused because he found no solution at all to describe the vacuum state. So whatever he did, he found there are particles. The outside observer here will see particles at some point or other. So what is that? Is that an artifact of my methods? And that was what he thought in the beginning. He was doing something wrong because it's obvious that there should be a solution with black holes with no particles around. Until he made his really ingenious observation. He says, let's assume that those particles are real. They must be real particles. They seem to be artifacts coming out of a calculation, but then you say, wait a minute, if the calculation says that vacuum fluctuations will generate particles, then so be it. Maybe these particles arise from the past horizon out of vacuum fluctuations, and that turned out to be the only interpretation of his calculation that made sense. Black holes emit particles. In particular, it made sense when he computed, if that is so, what is the intensity of these particles? And the answer was the intensity is like a light bulb. It's thermal radiation. And as a rule of thumb, the temperature of the black hole radiation has a Wien wavelength, which is of the same order of magnitude as the radius of the black hole. So large black holes have a large Wien wavelength, which means very low temperature radiation coming out. The very tiny black holes have radiation coming out that's very intense. But of course, it comes out from a very tiny surface area by that time. But still, the radiation intensifies if you go to smaller and smaller black holes. So the observation was that actually, if you have a black hole, there is no lowest energy state. By the way, the vacuum, of course, is the definition, by definition, the lowest energy state that you can get. Well, if you have a black hole, that's not the lowest energy state, period. So it shouldn't be surprising that if you try to do formal, precise physics, you find there is no vacuum around the black hole because you're not talking about the lowest energy state. You're talking about the black hole. The lowest energy state is a state with no black hole at all. And if you argue that way, then you can understand why it's not unreasonable that Hawking found that there are particles surrounding a black hole. And so this is a shorthand way of formulating the result. A black hole emits particles by means of tunneling. And this is Hawking radiation. Now, there are many technicalities I will skip, and one of the technicalities is this calculation. It's a beautiful mathematical argument, but it makes certain assumptions that he found totally natural, which is that once an object went into a black hole, it's lost forever. It will never come out. And that means that he couldn't describe quantum mechanics the usual way. He could not describe quantum mechanics in terms of pure quantum states. He was forced to, what he actually found out is that the description, the quantum description of the particles that they are emitted by a black hole is particles that are in thermal equilibrium. It's thermal radiation. Therefore, it has to be described by a quantum mixed state. There was a question there. Oh, okay. So one of the questions that, you, as a theoretical physicist, I want to answer is what happens at the very end. A black hole emits radiation, but the radiation goes with the fourth power of the temperature times the surface area that's emitting the radiation. The surface area is 1 over the mass of the black hole square. The temperature is 1 of the mass of the black hole. So if you calculate the net intensity of the radiation, it becomes more intense when the black hole is smaller, because m to the fourth beats the 1 over m squared for the surface area. So the total intensity goes quadratically inversely proportional to the square of the radius. And that happens to be the surface area of the black hole. So that means that the black hole is losing energy, and that loss of energy goes faster when it becomes small, so it must end up with a big explosion. And one of the physical questions is, what happens at that explosion? That, at the same time, the most difficult question of all. Question of intermediate difficulty is, what happens when the black hole is still big, it's emitting particles, but I don't want to describe that in terms of a mixture of quantum states. I want pure quantum mechanics. And to my claim is that the result he came with makes no sense, because he describes black holes in many different possible quantum states. What it really means is he doesn't know what the pure quantum state is. So we should replace the mixed state he's talking about by a pure quantum state. many people agree with that. In particular, string theorists now also came with their ways of writing models of black holes, as stack of D-brains and such. And they also find that there you can count the number of states of quantum states. And sure enough, you get pure quantum states. So they say, okay, this is what Hawking said. It was wrong, makes no sense. String theory gives the right answer, it's pure states. The answer is not that easy as that, because then the question is, why did Hawking get the wrong answer? And why is it so hard for him to describe black holes in terms of pure quantum states? Because you might say that the black hole often is so large that assuming quantum mechanics as we know it today, including the standard model of all elementary particles, should be more than enough to describe exactly what the black hole does, not only in some approximation, but in a very much better approximation than to say that it is a mixture of quantum states. It should be possible to write down a pure quantum state for a black hole. And the question is, if so, what is that pure quantum state? How do I describe it? And then you find that even though string theorists also say they are pure states, but if you describe from basic principles, starting with a standard model, imposing that on the black hole, you find it can't be pure states. So that's going to be a contradiction. And that's, of course, that's where we theoretical physicists wake up and say, contradiction means that something is not the way it is like written in the textbook. We have to do it better. Now, I go to these four pictures are very essential, what I'm having to say. That is, this is again this quadrant with all the ingoing particles. The ingoing particles now include the particles that were made during the implosion. Before the implosion, there was no black hole. So before the implosion, you have flat space-time sitting here, actually. But now comes the danger of this exponential compression. This Penrose diagram is exponentially compressed here. So when you wait a little bit more in time, the exponents become huge. And these particles carry more momentum in these coordinate frames, and they carry more momentum than the entire momentum of mass in the universe. So there's much more energy on this line here than energy in the entire universe. That's totally crazy and silly and also wrong. So we have to do something about that. But we can also say the black hole emits particles. According to Hawking, these are very soft particles. They are particles with the mean temperature, so it means very low temperature particles. They should never have much effect on the gravitational field. But if you again take this Penrose diagram, and now you look at all the outgoing particles are here also exponentially compressed. So an observer very late in the future is sitting here. That observer sees particles coming out, but those particles first have to be stretched out. So when you look at the time dependence of this quadrangle, it stretches out in one direction, it shrinks in the other direction. That's because a time boost for the distant observer is a Lorentz boost here. And Lorentz boosts in the light cone coordinates contract the light cone coordinates in that direction and expand it in that direction, or the other way around. So these outgoing particles also are represented by particles which, for the early observer, have exponentially high energy and momentum. So high that the whole picture that Hawking used to do his computation breaks down, because he assumes that space-time is regular in this domain. And indeed, the classical behavior of black holes in general relativity, to explain the LIGO observations and so on, are all assuming that nothing comes out of the black hole. Hawking radiation comes out, but that's so weak you can't observe that. But Hawking radiation, perhaps it's weak when the moment it comes out, but if you extrapolate those particles back in time, they become very energetic. So energetic that it's going to be illegal to pass this line at all. That's what I call a firewall. It is related to the firewall that string theorists are talking about when they get into their problems. But they think of this singularity generated here in a very different way. And now comes this third picture, says I put both ingoing particles and outgoing particles. But in this picture, I only include ingoing particles that only went in very shortly ago, so not yet so much compressed that they generate a large amount of energy. And I only look at outgoing particles, which come out rather early. I don't wait for the particles that come out very late, because I won't see them yet. So in that case, there is no problem with very high energetic particles, and distance ought to be the preferred picture. And actually, when you talk about scattering theory, this is like the mode where you look at the in particles that are going into the object to be scattered. Here you see only the outgoing particles. And in scattering theory, you know, there should be a transformation from the ingoing particle frame to the outgoing particle frame. And there's also an interaction frame where you only consider the particles while interacting, and that's this picture. So this is the picture that we want to get at, and I claim that not only that's what I want, but it's the only picture which gives completely reasonable answers, that I remove the very early ingoing particles and the very late outgoing particles, then the quantum mechanics of a black hole can be written down basically on the back of an envelope, because we know we have the standard model describing the particles in that space-time. We know the general relativistic equations for the background. We know the background is not affected by those particles because they all carry only low energies. And so this together should give me a complete way of doing quantum mechanics of the black hole. Except for one complication, and that is, as time goes on for the distant observer, the ingoing particles are being expanded and the outgoing particles are being compressed. But if you wait longer than just a few microseconds, you have made such a big Lorentz boost at the origin that now your originally soft particles become strong particles and vice versa. So you run into difficulties if you do this. And this is what you have to look at very carefully and resolve somehow. The resolution comes because you have taken into account that there's a gravitational interaction between in particles and out particles. And that is that's a crucial feature that we have to be aware of. You cannot ignore that there's gravitational interaction among the in particles and the out particles. Even though these out particles were very soft, they still feel very strong gravitational forces. But also the converse, the in particles are very soft when they're still far away to traveling inwards. You can limit yourself to very soft particles. So again, they will have a negligible effect on the space-time metric. But the gravitational interaction between in and out particles is important. So how does it work? Actually, it's very easy to compute. Conceptually, it's easy to explain how to do it. You first take a particle at rest. It is surrounded by the Schwarzschild metric. The Schwarzschild metric is usually negligible. If you take a neutrino, think of putting a neutrino at rest and calculate its gravitational field. That's absurd, it's extremely weak. But if you give this neutrino momentum of a billion TeV, then its gravitational field might become sizable anyway. So the way to compute that is to just take the Schwarzschild metric of a particle at rest and then Lorentz boost that result. We all know how to do a Lorentz boost, even if you have a curved space-time. And the outcome of that is very simple, that the Schwarzschild metric, like anything else when you make a Lorentz boost, gets flattened. So this is flattened in the direction of motion. Suppose the particle moves inwards in this direction, then its gravitational field gets flattened. And this becomes very similar to the electromagnetic field, which is also flattened, which gives you a shock wave. That's very well known. It's called Cherenkov radiation. If a particle moving at the speed of light or faster, then it's surrounded by a shock wave, and that shock wave gives Cherenkov radiation. So this is gravitational Cherenkov radiation, not faster than the speed of light, but moving essentially with the speed of light. Then you get gravitational Cherenkov radiation. The more the momentum is of the particle, forget about its rest mass, that it becomes invisible, but the momentum becomes the source of gravity. And so the momentum, if it's large enough, then this gravitational field becomes sizable. And actually, the computation is very nice. If you do that computation, so you have a fast particle here and a slowly moving spectator particle. What happens to the spectating particle? Well, it gets shifted. This shift is very much like the Shapiro shift that you get when you look at the light signal that grazes over the sun's surface. And then you see a star behind the sun. That star is not only displaced, it's gravitational. Its signal also is delayed by a certain amount in time. This time delay is the main effect that survives when the particle moves very fast. So what you get is in front of the particle, there's flat space-time. Behind the particle, there's flat space-time. But these two flat space-times are glued together with the shift. So when a particle enters here, it's being dragged along and re-emerges here. Actually, this line is continuously connected to that one. So, but if I draw both regions of space-time as flat space-time, then the easiest way to describe the gravitational interaction is to say that one particle here drags along the other particle. That drag would have been unphysical if it did not depend on the transverse coordinates. But the whole thing becomes physically important when you realize that the drag depends on where you are, logarithmically as a function of the displacement. But the transverse displacement, x tilde means transverse x. The transverse displacement, the logarithm of that is that drag. Everything of this equation could have been guessed. The logarithm is a solution of a Laplace equation in two dimensions, because the transverse space is two-dimensional. So no surprise that there's a log here. The only thing you have to calculate is the minus 4. Also, Newton's constant here. Also, there's a shift in the minus light cone coordinates goes proportional to the shift of the minus momentum coordinate. These both transform the same way under a Lorentz transformation. So this expression is invariant or covariant under Lorentz transformations in the same direction. So and this has been observed long ago, even before the 1970s. Already this notion has been observed. You can do the same thing for a particle falling into a black hole. Only the transverse space now becomes the sphere of the horizon rather than flat space-time. So the logarithm is replaced by some spherical harmonic function of the theta and the phi on space-time. But everything else remains much the same way. So the ingoing particles have the effect of shifting the outgoing particles. And the nasty thing about the shift is the outgoing particles might be shifted all across the horizon. It wanted to come out first, it's been shifted to go back in. So imploding particles can send other matter back into the black hole while before these particles were arriving, these objects thought they were leaving, but no. I can take this into account, and now I can do the calculation. But before showing the result of the calculation, there are still at least two problems, if not more. So there's some very important steps to be made. So as time goes by, the ingoing particles move from future to past. That's just a way of saying that you have to use new coordinates if you wait a little bit in time. And the new coordinates are Lorentz transformations of the old coordinates. And what you now find is that because of this shift, remember that the shift of the outgoing particles was proportional to the momentum of the ingoing particles.
Yeah, the question. What do you mean by future to past? Where did that come from?
Well, it's a way of saying. Don't pay too much attention
to
it.
But it looks like it went to the future. There wasn't anything that goes. You're saying.
Well, if I want to describe a particle that is emitted in the future, then I have to use coordinates where I send these future space-time points back to the past, and then the particle is coming out in the past. So it's a way of saying, don't pay too much attention to it. I'm not trying to say something deep physically. It's just I just a way of saying that if you look at very late particles, you have to use a different coordinate frame. And that coordinate frame is Lorentz transformed with respect to the previous one. So very soon, the particles for which this is important is the particles which come out very late and the particles which go in very early. Then this shift actually blows up exponentially. And what you now get, the equation I had just before was the equation that relates momentum of ingoing particles to positions of outgoing particles. To go from momentum to position, and now we use quantum mechanics, if you talk about wave functions, that's a Fourier transform. So the ingoing particles affect on the outgoing particles by Fourier transformation. And the nice thing about Fourier transformation is that if you have a slowly varying function on one axis, the Fourier transform is a fast varying function on the other axis. So you see that in and out didn't change because exponential expansion and exponential compression are interchanged by the Fourier transform. So you see how things are hanging together. Of course, I was using Lorentz invariants all the time in that direction, so I should not be surprised that it all fits with Lorentz transformations. So this works beautifully. So if you see that now the ingoing particles leave their footprints on the outgoing particles. The step I make is, as I say, those are not the footprints, they're the outgoing particles themselves. One extra ingoing particle shifts all the extra outgoing particles by a certain amount. But if I take all the particles which ever went in, they might determine the position of the outgoing particles. So I say U minus of the outgoing particles is P minus of the ingoing particles. As soon as I say that, then I've reduced the size of Hilbert space. I say I don't have independently ingoing particles and outgoing particles. No, the outgoing particles I have are determined by the ingoing particles. This works extremely well. It generates what I claim to be a unitary just category matrix, except you have to make another step. And the other step is that if, what happens if a particle is being dragged along across the horizon? What do you do? And the answer to that is then here I have the horizon magnified again. I have a fast ingoing particle. It drags all the outgoing particles along. So this particle wanted to come out here, now dragged to this spot. This particle here will be dragged in that direction. Here a particle is dragged across the horizon. It was supposed to go in here. Now it's dragged along the horizon. But across here, in this domain, time runs backwards. This is something to get used to. And normally people try to ignore that, that there's a time runs forward in this part of the universe. Time runs essentially backwards in this part of the universe. As soon as you say that these two space-times are connected. The two space-times are connected because there's no singularity, because I removed all the very fast particles going in and the very fast particles going out. Because I removed those, the particles have practically no effect on the space-time metric. I should solve Einstein's equations all the way. So that's the Penrose diagram. Not only contains this region 1, it also contains region 2 and actually region 3 here as well. They're all now in my picture. And then the act of Lorentz of Fourier transformation becomes unitary. The Fourier transformation is unitary only if you integrate from minus infinity to plus infinity. It's not unitary if you integrate from minus infinity to zero. And in fact, you see this particle crosses the zero. And if I ignore this crossing, and if I ignore the fact that this particle now continues its way in this direction, then I'm making a mistake. But if you do this the way it's indicated on this graph, then you get a unitary scattering matrix. So this is something very problematic to explain, and many people are violently opposed to it. But this is a Penrose diagram of the eternal black hole. This thing has no particles in its past making it. It was always there. The reason why the particles in the past are not making this, this black hole is that I've removed the ingoing particles of the explosion. They are too long ago. It's like saying, I want to describe the hydrogen atom, but I have the hydrogen atom here. I want to understand the quantum states. I don't care how it was made during the Big Bang and what happened there, whether there was a singularity or not. I want to describe the black hole, the hydrogen atom as it is now. So also I want to describe the black hole as it is today. And today it looks like an eternal black hole. I can't see the imploding particles anymore. But then I've doubled up the Penrose diagram. And so I have this domain and I have that domain. And the question is, what is this? And now you have many people, I think there are about as many answers as there are physicists working on this problem. One famous answer is so-called ER equals EPR idea, that somehow the these are describing two entangled black holes.
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay, thank you. At first, it was thought the region 2 refers to the inside of the black hole. That cannot be right because the region 2 is exactly a mirror image of the entire universe, region 1. So it also has asymptotic states. So it can't be the inside of the black hole because inside the black hole should be a finite box of some sort, but not an infinite box that contains asymptotic domains as well. So, and this is the this is basically ER equals ER assumption that they say this thing does not describe one black hole, it describes two black holes that are entangled. Why on earth they say that's entangled escapes me a little bit. And also how you can maintain the idea that you're describing two black holes rather than one also escapes me. I think logically speaking, what you really want to describe a single black hole. So I'm not in favor of this picture at all. And the problem is I can't understand what it is that these two entangled black holes represent. Also, if you say that, you have unitarity in a two black hole Hilbert space. But you want unitarity in a single black hole Hilbert space. And that is then violated because the two black holes, entangled or not, they are now interacting. And the problem with the EPR, comparing this with the EPR experiment, the two photons that EPR are talking of are not directly interacting. They are entangled, all right, but not interacting directly. So these two black holes you talk about are interacting. And in that case, you can't really hold up this picture either. But you have to do something. If you ignore it, you will not get a unitary S matrix. So the only thing I came up with, and this is the title of my talk, basically, that you have to identify these two regions. How do I do that? If I identify them directly, I get a singularity at the horizon itself. The singularity is so bad that I can't do physics with such a singularity. That would be a real physical singularity that spoils all my calculations. But the way to avoid that singularity is something that's very natural once you have realized what you're doing, is that you have to identify the points of region one with the antipodes of the points of region two. Antipodes in the transverse direction. So the theta and phi of the points in region one are mapped onto pi minus theta and phi plus pi. The antipolar points are then identified. Mathematically, this is trivial. Mathematicians have no difficulties with this at all. You just say you're taking a folded space-time. Physically, it's nice because this generates no singularity whatsoever. It generates a singularity at the original singularity of the black hole, which already was singular, where I equals zero. But I just explained that I equals zero is not physically not important. In fact, the coordinate I, Schwarzschild coordinate I, will never be less than 2gm. So far away from zero, that is not a singularity. So one might have thought that this violates causality. Also, remember, time is reversed when I do this identification. So this looks like something absolutely awful. And the amazing thing is it works so well that it generates a completely unitary black hole scattering matrix. I wish I could go through those calculations, but that would bring me too far. I'm already getting over time now. So basically, the difference is between this would be the ordinary space-time metric. These are two black holes, one sitting here and one sitting here. But what I do now is I erase one half of it, and I just declare that if you have a space-like geodesic, which goes in this direction from to this circle here, then it hops and the geodesic continues. Well, in the old picture, it would continue just like that, but now it's flipped over and it goes back into the same metric here. So you never get out of the physical domain of the black hole. What is nice about this is now if you do quantum field theory on this space-time, you find that all the states as your pure quantum states on the original big space-time with the two regions now becomes a pure quantum state on this reduced space-time just by putting a quantum continuity boundary condition at this spot. So that now my wave functions are pure wave functions in the physical universe only. This way you restore purity of quantum mechanics. And this way you can make a scattering matrix. You can also count quantum states now. And that part is still difficult, but let me just briefly give you another description, which is equivalent by saying that a black hole is like what I call a vacuole, an empty region of space-time, which is so empty that it doesn't even contain particles. There is simply nothing in this white region. So you have ordinary space-time as a blue region. If you hit this line here, for instance, at this blue cross, you just hop over to this blue cross and you continue your way. And but while hopping over, you also make a jump from time to minus time. So that's a very crazy boundary condition. The only reason for me to work with it is that it gives me a unitary scattering matrix. So the black hole can go.
What happens if I fall into a black hole?
Pardon?
What happens to me if I fall into a black hole?
Well, you continue, but you'll be overcounted. Your footprint, your gravitational footprint will affect the outgoing particles. All information in your body will be in those outgoing particles, scrambled because they are Fourier transformed. You yourself can think you are continuing, and I say that's very similar to the situation of going to complex coordinates. And you can ask yourself, what happens if I sit on a planet that goes into complex space?
I go to the other side of the black hole and come out.
Doesn't he just bounce out?
This is the same. This here is time reverse. It's the same part of the black hole that you can't follow this journey because you would have to go faster than the local speed of light. If you could travel into the black hole faster than light, which is possible mathematically for the geodesics, but not for physical particles, so you will not be able to go faster than light into a black hole, then you'll be able to, then you find yourself coming out on the other side, even worse than faster than light, you'd go backwards in time, you'll go out. So. It sounds very crazy, but the whole thing mathematically is that it works. I had some pictures which are now starting to Oh, I don't have. I was looking for a picture, but oh. No. I don't know what's going wrong here, but.
You're going fast, then speed up.
I'm going fast, speed up. Okay, forget this, forget this. I was.
Lines are generally identical.
Yes, and going backwards in time also. So, yeah, I'm sorry about that. No, I thought I had some pictures here on the screen. They have been removed. So basically, this is my main message, that it works. I cannot go into all the technical details. I'm already over time, so that will only make things worse. So, but if you have some basic questions, I can try to explain in ordinary words what's happening and why the theory works. It's the main message is that you can try any other thing, but you don't get any meaningful scattering metrics if you try something else. But that was the main message. Thank you very much.
So this is this, sorry, go ahead. Construction, it looks like the kind of thing Jorma Luco and Don Meroff looked at with the geon, where you make this antipodal identification that is about 20 years ago. Is this the same construction?
I don't know about that particular thing, so I can't really tell. I know that Whiting and Sanchez, even longer ago, came with such a proposal, but they abandoned it, sort of. And,
well, the reason why I'm asking is that this is fine. It looks very similar. So assuming it's either the same or very similar, one of the problems is when you have black holes with other properties, then you cannot always make this kind of identification. You're exploiting a lot of the symmetries.
I am using, of course, I'm using that the black hole reaches an exponential limit as time goes on. And those limits are only, they belong to the well-known classes, the Schwarzschild, the Kerr, the Kerr-Newman solutions.
Even there, you can't always do that. If they have certain kinds of conserved charges or space-time has other structures, then you do have constraints on this. And so, I mean, maybe that's okay. I guess you could say then the only black holes that make physical sense are the ones where you're allowed to do the construction.
It would seem to
me that would be a constraint.
Oh, I don't know. I haven't encountered such constraints. What I found is that you need to make a mapping, which is an element of O3, basically an element of the isometry of the solution. Now, even the Kerr-Newman has an isometry if I go from points to antipoints. Because
you need a freely acting involute of isometry, but you don't always have that. That's the problem.
Well,
so when you make the identification, you'll get singularities sometimes. And so you have a subset of black holes where you don't get singularities.
Certain types of
rotating black holes, for example.
But I haven't encountered such things in the case of the Kerr-Newman, for instance, which is pretty general.
Well, I'll send you the reference on this, but there are some constraints. So then I guess you could say that any black holes that for which it doesn't work are just bad black holes.
The point is, of course, if the black hole does not have a killing vector in the time direction, which may be the things you're talking about, then it's not so easy to do this anymore.
Well, that would be another example. Yeah.
That would be okay, but those are only very temporary solutions anyway. I have to make the mapping of the Lorentz transform at the horizon to the time boost for a distant observer. So that you have to understand. But but I'd like to have that reference from you, yes.
In the final picture that you paint, I don't see where the original information, what form the black hole has gone. Is it clear?
Well, all the information sent in is being copied by this Shapiro effect onto the outgoing particles. So all information in is now in the outgoing particles. This is an elementary ingredient without which this whole theory would make no sense. So you do need this.
But the question is, in the final space-time you're using, where do I know what formed the black hole? Can I know it?
Most of the argument is totally classical. Most of this is just totally classical. So it's standard general relativity, I mean. standard relativity also tells you what happens when you have certain instates and you see an horizon opening up. So, for instance, take a spherical shell of matter, which is my favorite because it's so easy mathematically. If it's spherically symmetric, then you see a horizon opening up in the inside the shell at some totally regular point. You can't say in advance where that point will be unless you solve the equations.
No, of course. But general relativity, as we know, cannot give the information what form the black hole. The question is, you, I suppose, claim that this is somehow knowing this information in its unit, right?
I think the answer to such questions in general is that you have an enormous amount of similarity transformations, much like in a gauge theory. So when you go from rectangular coordinates to polar coordinates, there's a transformation. And to go to coordinates where you have a horizon opening up is just a kind of transformation of that sort. Actually, the question about the black hole forming is the hardest of all. So there you have to say exactly what happens when the horizon opens up. And how do I then reinstall, so to speak, this different language onto that configuration? The claim is, even during a very short moment, the black hole, that's to say the cross-section of my Cauchy surface with the horizon, is a very tiny sphere. That very tiny sphere still obeys Planckian physics, whatever that is. So I say, okay, I blame that to my lack of knowledge about what happens at the Planck scale. So I say, at the Planck scale, you say, you have to switch the topology of space-time, but only at Planckian dimensions, so it should be regular from a physical point of view. But, okay, it's a reason to say why this, I think, is potentially very important. We're saying something non-trivial about Planck scale physics. You have to be able to make such transformations. As soon as you have the microscopic seed of a black hole, the seeds will just expand, and I can use this logic to say how a black hole expands and become a big black hole. But how the seeds comes about, it's like, well, you know, of course, the quantum mechanics, you have all the superpositions of states, which makes life more complicated now. But in principle, you assume that there will be a classical black hole formed, yes or no. And for large black holes, the distinction between the black hole state and a non-black hole state is very, very elementary and very important. But you have to understand how it got into being. And that is moving directly into Planck scale physics, which is, for me, very hard.
I just wanted to add a brief comment about what Rob and Rob's question, which is that I think that for the Kerr-Newman class of black holes, I think what Rob was saying is right, that there's a well-defined identification, but it's, you know, once charge is in the game, it's really an action like CPT that the identification is under, and so it's very analogous to something that's this now. Similar sort of identification that Neil and I have been interested in the cosmological context. So I think for a Kerr-Newman it's fine.
The strange thing to get used to is that time goes to minus time in this identification, which is something you have to get used to until you realize what all it does is the Cauchy surfaces go like this inside the black hole. So inside the black hole, normally Cauchy surfaces run from past to future, but inside the black hole they rotate. So they go forward in time here and backwards in time there. And that's the transformation. And that transformation is unitary. So that's why it works so well. But I like to know the reference.
So if we take around again,